Hey everyone, Brock Cannon here. Welcome back to the Brock Cannon Podcast. On this week's episode, I had the privilege of sitting down with Lance Allred. You guys, Lance is going to blow your mind. Like, I don't know how else to say it. He's incredible. He's just a human. He's a father. We share a lot in common as professional, former professional athletes, and some of the challenges that we've dealt with masculinity and just our evolution spiritually. But man, what a well-rounded guy. What a fascinating background. Lance actually was the first legally deaf player in the NBA. He didn't get into the NBA till he was 27, which is about 7 years later than the average NBA player. And before that, of all places, Lance was born and raised in a polygamist commune in rural Montana before his family left at the age of 13. They were basically disowned. They lost everything. They had to start all over again. So standing at 6'11", he wasn't able to play basketball with his hearing aids. And, you know, just talk about persistence. This guy ends up going to the University of Utah, playing on the year that they went to the national championship, ends up playing for the Cleveland Cavaliers. He's played basketball on every single continent. But what really just like blew my mind recently about Lance was his latest book. It's called The New Alpha Male. I picked it up. I literally couldn't put it down. I read the book in like 3 days, and I just resonated as a man with every single thing that he talked about. So in this episode, we're going to talk a lot about, you know, how we hide as men. We're going to talk about different archetypes, just some really, really fascinating stuff. And Lance is going to share his perspective. And, you know, this is like a treat. This guy's probably like too big for my podcast, you know, because he's like literally spoken to corporations all over the world. He's trained the FBI. Like, this guy's been everywhere. He has a TEDx talk that has almost 5 million views called What Is Your Polygamy? I would also highly recommend checking out that TED talk by Lance if you haven't already. So without further ado, you guys, you're in for a real treat this week. Let's get into it. Ladies and gentlemen, Lance Allred. All right, everyone. So welcome to the Brock Cannon Podcast. This is episode number 37. So excited to be joined by Lance Allred today. As you guys may or may not know, Lance is really, really an anomaly. He's the first deaf professional player in the NBA and just an all-around amazing guy. I had the privilege to be on Lance's podcast over 5 years ago to talk about my book. It was over 5 years ago, man.
Oh, man. Jeez. Yeah.
So now I've got him on here. I literally just devoured his book. It's called The New Alpha Male. It's, you know, beneficial for men and women. We're going to get into his book. But, like, literally, guys, couldn't put the book down. I just devoured it in 3 days and could not highly recommend the book more. So, Lance, welcome to the show, man. It's good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks, Brock. And it's good to be here. And I'm just smiling, thinking 5 years ago when we last saw each other when I was doing the Culture Jock podcast for a year. I learned a lot, but it helped me get started with what I do now. And you were a great resource as a guest for me 5 years ago. So I'm very happy to return the favor, man.
Hey, thanks for being on, man. So for those that are not familiar with your background, and obviously I'm going to have a very thorough introduction, which will be tacked onto this podcast, but for those not super familiar with your background, give us just, you know, a little bit about where you grew up, because it's pretty unique. We actually have a lot of similarities, but I think yours is even a little bit more extreme, you might say. Tell us about your background and kind of how you ended up in the NBA.
Oh, well, the reason why I have hearing loss, I was born and raised in my grandfather's polygamist colony in rural Montana, and they didn't think about things called the rhesus factor or the Rh factor. And so my mother was an O negative, I was O positive. And so I was an Rh baby, and I was near death when I was born. My liver bilirubin titer count was off the charts. I have an extra vertebrae, all those funky things that come with all the mythology surrounding the O negative blood type and everything. And so I'm very lucky to be alive, but one of the aftermaths of the blood transfusion process, being in an incubator for 3 weeks after I was born, was hearing loss. So about 80% hearing loss due to the Rh factor. And it was, again, an anomaly that why I'm even alive. So my mother took me out of the commune to tiny Hamilton, Montana, where there was a Johns Hopkins educated resident who specialized in Rh because he was an Rh baby himself. And just by that grace alone, he was able to save my life. My mortality rate, I should have been dead. My liver titer count was off the charts. And so the doctor even said, I would publish this in the Journal of American Medicine, but no one would believe me.
Wow.
And there are two reasons why I'm alive. I chose to be. And number two, there was always someone there to help me along the way. And you and I, we've done enough self-development that we kind of have to endure some of the successful influencers who act as though they did it all on their own merit. But when you play this game long enough, you also know that someone has to open a door for you along the way. And I've been fortunate in my life to have so many people at the right time there to open a door for me, so to speak.
Oh, that's amazing, man.
To finish answering your question. Yeah. So my family broke away from polygamy when I was 13. My father blew the whistle on child abuse and money laundering. So we had to go into hiding. The FBI came and got us out of our house. So pretty dramatic and intense upbringing. And I can tell you, I mean, I'm so grateful for that upbringing. But it wasn't, your quintessential American childhood. It was very serious. I was a very stoic kid. Don't have a lot of giggling, laughing memories. It was, we're here, pedal to the metal right out of the gate. And in the culture, that was very much us against the world. We're God's chosen people. So very much in survival mode all the time. And then we leave that intensity and we amplify the survival mode. And so luckily at that age, in beginning of eighth grade, when we had broken away from polygamy, I went through my growth spurt, 5'10 to 6'4. And I'd never played basketball before that point. I was a writer as a kid with my hearing loss and speech impediment, being in speech therapy until I was 16. My parents encouraged me to read and write as a form of communication to express myself. And so I was just that guy. And I always said I was a writer who happened to play basketball, not the other way around. And luckily, losing that sense of community at the age of 14, all my cousins who had been my best friends, luckily basketball then appeared as a way for me to segue into the mainstream world, where the growing pains were less intense, but still intense. Mm-hmm. Having to learn to acclimate myself and develop social skills that when you're raised on the fringes of society in an elite culture that you're God's chosen people, you don't spend too much time developing social skills and learning how to compromise and work with other people. And it's been funny watching a lot of the fringe conspiracy cultures now trying to come into politics and take that same mentality that I was raised with. Our way or the highway, that we will literally die on this hill, pretty much on every agenda, that there's no compromise. Mm-hmm. And so it's been fascinating to watch the culture that my family escaped from eke its way into the mainstream, into the political narrative. And I'm not going to lie, it's brought up a lot of triggers for me, a lot of anxiety. I'm like, wait, I thought I left this behind, but like an episode of Stranger Things, we thought we sealed that wall off when I was a kid and was going through counseling and therapy. And but like any good series, there's a crack emerge right from the cave and the black ooze comes out, and now all these conspiracy theories are chasing you into the mainstream world and you're like, what the hell is going on? And so there's always a never-ending journey, Brock, of reflection and growth. And when those triggers come, instead of being activated by the triggers, just saying, okay, this is some more healing and some more reflection that can be done.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems that the triggers never seem to stop. But I think you and I both, it seems that in our journey, we've learned that the triggers may not stop, but we see the triggers differently. And I think from reading your book, it seems that we both used to want to escape the triggers. We wanted to run from the pain or numb the pain. Yep. And now it's about facing the pain and figuring that out. Yep. So
you have to face it. That's half the battle.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's just so much in your book that I want to uncover here, but like, I'm just going to tell everyone watching or listening, like, go get the damn book. Like, it's so, so good. I mean, I literally, Lance, I kid you not, I had tears coming out of my eyes within the first 15 minutes. And I was just like, holy smokes. Like I needed to read this book. And, you know, you started playing basketball. You had written your goals out above your light switch every single day. You were manifesting or calling into effect, like where you wanted to be. You wanted to get a scholarship. So you ended up at the University of Utah from there, correct?
Mm-hmm. University of Utah. My dream had come true. This is 1998, the year that Utah lost to Kentucky in a national championship game. I got a scholarship that year. And so it wasn't just, oh, he's a local kid going to a local school. It was a local kid that's going to a top five program.
Yeah.
And it was a dream come true until, as most of us learn, that sometimes dreams turn into nightmares. And sometimes dreams are never quite where you expect them to be, because the Hollywood movies never show us what happens the day after the triumphant kiss in the rain and the happily ever after. They never show us what happens. And we think it's going to be easy sailing from there, and it's not. And we've all learned that in some way, shape, or form. Whether it's a dream job or a marriage or a relationship. And yet we still keep trying to chase that dopamine high that we have been conditioned to think that satisfaction is happiness. Mm. That's what people are chasing. They're chasing the satisfaction dopamine high. We've been conditioned to believe that's what happiness is. But inevitably, that satisfaction always wears off. And yet we have this unattainable illusion that, oh, well, I'm married to someone now, but the bliss has worn off, like all things do. They must not be my soulmate. So I got to go back out there and keep chasing that next high. Find the next person that's going to make me feel this dopamine kick constantly. And, you know, sometimes it triggers people, but I don't apologize for it, that we have pornography and romantic movies being the same drug. Mm-hmm. For men, you have pornography creating unrealistic expectations about women. Mm-hmm. Romantic movies, you have that now unrealistic expectations about men being created for women, that mm-hmm. both require the opposite gender to embarrass or humiliate themselves. How many romantic movies have we seen where the male in a romantic comedy does something completely self-effacing at the end of the movie to show this girl how much he loves her? Same happens in pornography. And yet now we have these addictive chemicals that we've been so programmed now that we're chasing, and it's unattainable. Mm-hmm. And whether it's romance or the dream job or the trophies or whatnot, that we have been conditioned as a society that our worth is obviously attached to these outcomes, these metrics that are fluid constantly, that will always be moving, that they're not just some trophies that you put on, that even if you buy that boat, it's going to deteriorate, it's going to lose value. It just does. And so learning from the University of Utah, to go back to the initial point, was the disenchantment that came from that. And some of the stuff that happened when I left, I transferred to Weber State. I was diagnosed with PTSD when I left the University of Utah about some of the stuff that went on behind closed doors. And so not only was there the death of a dream and a very toxic relationship with a coach, there was also the community aspect involved, where the community pressure was involved and everyone was gossiping and thinking they knew what went on. And so you had to learn very early on at that time, as you're a kid becoming a teenager and maturing into a man, in the birth of the chat room era, to really develop the thick skin or just have the discipline to not even look at comments. But realizing that it's all the same, whether it's people gossiping about Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, or gossiping about their favorite basketball player, or hating on their basketball player for having a bad game. It's people wanting the belief of something perfect.
Right.
To strive for it. But when you actually get to go into the belly of the beast and peek behind the curtain of Oz, disenchantment comes. But that's not to say that I still didn't have, oh, well, I'm going to make the NBA, because that even impressed upon me as a young kid that God had made me deaf as a form of punishment. And so even though we broke away from polygamy, when you're a kid and you're absorbing all of these cultural truths, you don't have the ability to discern fact from fiction at that point. Your frontal lobe isn't fully developed. And so you're not able to say, oh, is that true or not? But you take these quote truths and they get stored in your basic background RAM operating system in your brain, as though these are the baseboard truths from which you now move into this world or reality that you want to call it. So even after we broke away from polygamy, I still had this story that God was angry with me and I had to do something superhuman and then I'd be worthy of his love. And so there was, okay, well, I have to be the first legally deaf player in the NBA and then God would be proud of me. It didn't. My first game as a basketball player in eighth grade, I was ejected because the ref thought I was ignoring him. And I had to learn to play in a very different way. And people were already like, yeah, no, he's too deaf. He can't do this. And learning that while, yes, I have I don't want to say disability, but I have the crux of not being able to hear on the basketball court because I can't play with my hearing aids in, that yeah, I'm going to get hit hard on screens. I'm not going to always hear the right plays. Sometimes I'll run the wrong play because I'm trying to read their lips. And the coach won't use a hand signal because he's afraid of the other team knowing the play, but which is silly because 24 seconds, you can only be so brilliant. And so if you run a good offense, the defense always has to give you something. That being said, I would still mess things up. And on the other hand, not being able to hear forced me to be much more cerebral, forced me to always keep my head on a swivel, develop peripheral vision and watch people and read their body language. And so there was a lot of challenges that turned into skills that made me different, that made me unique. I wasn't the most athletic player, but I was unique. I wasn't competing for the same market that so many of these other seven footers were competing for. And that's what allowed me to have the 10-year professional career that I had. But through it all, going through a crazy college career, then playing overseas for a year, then in the minor leagues, then getting called up to the NBA, my dream had come true. And so I'd done something that people said could never be done. I made the NBA when I was 27 years old. That's 7 years longer than the average rookie. And I was shooting a free throw in front of 16,000 people. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is my happy Hollywood ending. I'm going to feel amazing. Oh, this is, instead it was, is this it? I don't feel any different. That the expectation, reality can never live up to my expectations. Reality can never live up to any of our expectations, maybe for a day or a week, but for a month, a year, not likely. And so with that came severe disenchantment. You know, you see the politics behind the NBA. They're like, wait, it's not pure merit? Come on. When you have that much money involved, of course it's going to be political. Let's not be naive about it. And then the economy of 2008 recession hit and I was released and a lot of other players were released. And so how about that for timing? You strive, you labor, and you get to your peak of your game.
Yeah.
And then it's, well, your timing was off. But you're like, all I can do is show up every day doing the best I can. As far as timing goes, I don't really have much control over that at the universal perspective. And so when I was released, I went through severe depression and nearly killed myself in Italy by jumping out of a window in 2009. And I had a choice in that moment. I can die with my stories, or my stories can die. One or the other. And so much of our stories, so much of our fears, our anxieties come from stories. And so much of our stories are driven from our culture. And our culture is our biggest blind spot. That the stories I was raised with as a kid in Mormonism and polygamy, that you have the pioneer heritage and martyrdom and duty and conditional love and a broody God that's watching you all the time. That's part of the culture. And yet with it comes these stories that are driving the narrative. And having played all around the world, and you read about this in the book in the first part that you mentioned, that I was playing in Japan, I was flying over Japan one day, and I had this thought that just hit me. And it was like, you know, our human brain is like an empty hard drive with its own little quirks, as each individual computer is, but the culture that we're born into is now the software operating system that gets installed into our hard drive. So in Japan, there may be Microsoft computers, and in America, we're Apple Macintosh, and yet here we are trying to communicate and saying they are inferior to me because they're not operating at the same value system algorithms as you hear Android, iPhone users clash all the time, judging each other because your system is inferior to mine.
Right.
That's what we humans do at the cultural level, failing to understand that our culture is our biggest blind spot. Our culture isn't necessarily true. It's just stories. And I was driven so long by these stories that they were controlling my life. I wasn't happy. And yet I was trying to live up to these impossible standards within a dying system of the Cold War era. As all things, evolution, everything must adapt and evolve or else it dies. And we're hearing a lot of this, oh, the way it used to be, which is 1950s, 60s America, when it was great for white middle-class people. Right. But even 50 years before that, before World War I, that was a very different America. 1860 Civil War, very different America. And so when people say, make America great again, as a history major, I just ask, well, which America are you talking about?
Right.
Which era?
Right.
And that's not how evolution works. And it's akin to me saying to an official, I don't like the way you have come out of halftime calling the game differently in the second half, which is what happens every game. Mm-hmm. Refs go into halftime, they assess, they figure out where do we need to clean the game up? Where do we need to be a little more loose, let them play? They change all the time at halftime. And I can sit there and throw a temper tantrum and get a technical foul and get ejected from the game and die on that hill, a martyr. Or I can say, all right, it's uncomfortable. I don't necessarily like it, but I understand to win the game, I have to be brave enough to adapt and pivot here. And that's what we're being asked as men and women, but men especially, because men like you and me, we were raised to be successful in a system that doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And it hurts and it's scary. And we can be angry about it. And we can come up with crazy, wacko conspiracies, wanting it to go back to the way it was. Or as a basketball player, I can translate my skills as a basketball player into the mainstream world and integrate all aspects of who I am, the athlete and the writer, and bring them together, no longer compartmentalized, and bring the athlete mentality into the mainstream world and understand, all right, it's a game. It's not a trivial game. It's not a flippant game, but it's a game. And am I brave enough to be flexible and adaptable? Because the greatest basketball players weren't necessarily the strongest or the fastest. It was those who are most able to evolve within each game, but also evolve between each season as the game continues to evolve. And can they keep up with it? And there are those who have the hubris to think, oh, they had arrived. They're the best in the world. They don't have to practice. They don't have to develop new skills. And then eventually their career is cut short. And I never prided myself on being the most athletic guy. And so I knew, all right, I have to make sure every offseason I am picking up new skills that the other teams, the Scademy, won't see coming, making me more and more difficult to guard. If you are hyper-masculine all the time, shooting the ball, macho, you pull yourself up by the bootstraps, cowboy up, American tough guy, you become very easy to guard because you are predictable.
Right.
And as a basketball player, if I want to shoot the ball every time I touch it, I am predictable and thus easy to guard. If I can only dribble with my right hand, I am easy to guard. But if I can score with my left and my right hand, no one knows which way I'm going to go, and therefore very difficult to guard. Same with those who just want to pass it every time. And so we have a lot of people trying to apply the same skills they had when they were in high school basketball, so to speak, thinking those same skills will allow them to translate and now play NBA basketball or college basketball. And as the world is evolving and growing, we can say, well, no, I want to stick with my high school skills and I should still get playing time. And it's like, you're not putting in any extra work. You're not developing the skills to adapt and evolve to warrant that we can even put you in the game and play. And rather than people being brave enough to say, one, the more I learn a lot, the more I learn how little I know. So therefore, I don't know anything. I mean, only, it's harsh but true, but like only smart people know how dumb they are. And so as you learn that, you're like, okay, I realize where I'm limited. And so therefore I have to adapt and evolve. But you have other people that are so insecure in their humanity, which is we are not that smart, which is that there is always room for growth, that nature asks us to continually grow and get out of our comfort zone. Again, as those who are most willing to adapt that survive. And it's scary and it's incredibly uncomfortable. That's what growth is. Growth is discomfort. And so you have this generation, not this generation, but you have this almost half of America throwing a temper tantrum saying, I don't want to have to grow. I don't want discomfort. I want my American dream now because I'm entitled to it. Mm-hmm. No, you're entitled to the pursuit of the American dream. And in that pursuit means struggle, failure, disappointment. But with that, you know, that's where the growth and that's where the magic of life is when you're stepping out of your comfort zone. And so that is what a lot of the message, and that's why it is, that's what it means to be a new alpha. These are uncomfortable things to do. These are hard things to do, and it's scary. So therefore, those who are alpha, to use, is kind of a tongue-in-cheek reference, because this outdated notion of alpha is tough guy, brass belt buckles, machismo, anyone can puff their chest. That's not hard to do at all. Anyone can act like a tough guy. It's like, okay, whatever, good for you. But are you brave enough to be vulnerable and humble and understand and have the humility that there is always room for growth, always room for improvement? And with that humility, Steve Nash, great guy. I loved being in the NBA at the same time he was. And he had a great saying one day where he says, yes, I worked hard and I had some talent and skills, but also I was fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time to have enough things go my way. And also knowing that nothing was promised to me. that's why the guy was able to play as long as he did. Again, this white Canadian guy wasn't the most athletic guy, but having the humility to know your weaknesses requires a lot of bravery in a world that, when we were raised in the Cold War era, there wasn't a lot of room for men to be vulnerable, to develop the skill set of self-intimacy, of self-reflection, of vulnerable conversation. And so we can shame men and say, oh, you're being a coward. But like, we also have to understand, it's one thing to shame them, but you have to realize a lot of us don't even have the foundational seeds to even build up this other dimension of ourselves and skill sets, because we weren't afforded that. And I'm not saying we have to tolerate intolerance, misogyny, or anything like that. No. Compassion is holding people accountable. If we don't hold people accountable, they do not grow. And so that is not compassionate. Not telling people truth is a very cruel thing to do. Yeah. Telling people harsh truths is a very compassionate thing to do. And people do not want to be lied to. More than people dislike more than people dislike hearing the things they don't want to hear, they dislike being lied to more than that.
Yeah.
And so asking men to adapt and evolve is a big task. And it takes people who have been badly wounded, women, other men who have been cruelly treated by a system of patriarchy, to instead of just say, oh, well, now you know what it feels like to be marginalized. Shaming people has never once brought about systemic change.
Yeah.
Never. Compassion and patience and allowing people the dignity to come back to light is what brings about systemic change. By being able to say, I hear what you're saying and you're scared. And thank you for articulating that. And we hear you and we see you and we're here and we're going to help you. It's a team effort. We're going to do it all together.
Yeah.
And that was a long tangent on the University of Utah question, but here we are.
Man, I'm just letting you go. And I know I could just let you go and you could talk this entire time without me asking a question, but there are a couple elements that you talked about in your book that I just thought were so, so incredibly timely for men particularly. And I'm trying to decide which one to talk to you about first, but I think I'm going to jump into this. The concept between a good guy and a nice guy.
Mm.
Dude, that just hit home and that was incredible. And it triggered me a little bit, Lance. It triggered me a little bit. It made me have some self-reflection to realize like, I've been a nice guy for a long time and that might not be the best thing. So tell everyone just a little bit about kind of the difference between the two and, you know, why men should strive a little bit more to be a good guy and what that means.
Good guys can be assholes. A nice guy is the most dishonest person in the world, because a nice guy never tells you truly what they're thinking, feeling, and wanting. And so a nice guy will manipulate people by being nice, by giving and giving, hoping that suddenly someone will read their mind and give them what they want. And then once you've been nice enough for so long and then people taking a few for granted or taking advantage of you, you then suddenly blow up because people aren't giving you back what you thought they should give you because you weren't brave enough to even articulate what it is that you were wanting in the first place. I am guilty of it as much as anyone. And I honor my parents and I love them. My father and mother overcorrected from a system of patriarchy, of polygamy, which is highly misogynistic in many ways. My brother and I were the two youngest. We had three oldest sisters. The girls were born first. And so my father, who went back to school when I was born, became the first person in the group to have a college degree because he injured himself, broke his leg twice in the same year in construction accidents in the commune. went on welfare, put his family on welfare, went back, graduated first in his class, University of Montana. Beautiful story.
Yeah.
In that education, and my mother not having been raised in polygamy, but her family converted, my mother having a different background, it was, we're going to give our daughters empowerment to speak their minds and speak their voices and truths. They put a lot of effort on that. And in reversal, it was lance and court, you're men. Women are to be treated always with respect. They are closer to God because they don't need the priesthood. And so therefore, I don't want to like put words in his mouth, but it was very much impressive. They are better than me. I have to earn their love. I have to win their approval. And you don't have to grow up in polygamy to have that same cultural impressions imprinted. And so my brother and I were taught to be the gentleman and always be ready to give, and you give. And I never once heard my father ever say no to my mother. Not once. And a lot of that stemmed from when I was born, the second wife had left. So I don't have any memories of polygamy in my immediate home. But my sisters would tell me that my father became very different in his dynamic with my mother once his second wife left, because my father, having lost a wife, going from polygamy, which is God's law, to monogamy, was no longer a worthy man to serve on the council, the highest offices in the commune, because he wasn't in polygamy. So therefore, he was inferior. He wasn't worthy enough to keep a second wife happy. He wasn't man enough to keep a second wife happy. And so my father definitely overcorrected by saying, well, I have Tana, my first wife, so she's the only woman I need. She's the most beautiful woman I need. She's the perfect woman I need, so I'm going to put her on a pedestal. And so my father honored my mother every day. He never did anything cruel or mean to her. And to my mother's credit, when she got what she asked for, she was consistent. She was even killed. And so I never heard my father say no to my mother. And so I never witnessed any skills or processes to how to have a healthy argument. How do I have healthy boundaries? How do I honor myself and honor the other person in this relationship by having clear, articulate boundaries? And so all I knew how to do was be a nice guy. And I was manipulating girls, playing games with them, playing games with myself, thinking, okay, well, where's my soulmate? My soulmate's just supposed to read my mind. And here I am, a kid who went to speech therapy for 6 years, 16 years, learning how to speak. And yeah, I'm like, well, what is that all for if I'm not going to be brave enough to even say what I authentically mean to say? What a waste of time it all was. And so learning that instead, well, them being in relationships with women and then giving them everything they ask for, and they're still being pissed at me and they're still resenting me. And that learning the hard way that the less and less I say no, the less and less they respect me. It's just this weird catch-22 that the movies tell us to be the prince, the knight in shining armor, and give them everything they want. And you realize that shit doesn't work at all. And learning through relationships and a marriage and painful divorce, that so much pain and frustration could have been avoided if I had just learned how to be a good guy. And a good guy is someone who integrates all aspects of who they are and does not apologize. A good guy is me being able to bring my athlete off the court and have him in a healthy dynamic in my home. When I was shamed again from my family background, when I started playing basketball, I came home with an attitude one day, kind of saying no to my mom and my sisters, and my dad shut it down so fast. Teaching me to compartmentalize my life, that the basketball player stays on court, nice Lance the Prince is the one at home. Learning as a good guy, I have to integrate them. That I can still honor and do my best to respect everyone and treat them with the dignity that everyone just deserves at a basic human level, and how I would like to be treated in kind. And if someone doesn't meet that, and if someone crosses it, being able to say, yeah, I don't respond well to that. Being able to say it very clearly, not in reaction or anger or trigger, by saying, if you want to have a healthy relationship with me, this is how I will respond to that kind type of request. And as uncomfortable and difficult as it may be, because a good guy would far rather be alone than in an unhealthy relationship. Nice guys would rather be in an unhealthy relationship than be alone. And so as a good guy, sometimes it means some days, if you want to call it asshole Lance, I call it basketball player Lance. And sometimes I will just, the cutthroat side of me will come out and I say, that's a line that's not going to be crossed. There's no budging on this. And if you have a problem with that and that's a deal breaker, okay. I would rather you be with someone that can meet your needs that you need right now than with me and resenting. And so when you are integrating and developing self-intimacy with who you are, all aspects of who you are, you no longer have that craving for someone else to come and fill this void that we all have when we are disintegrated with ourselves. As you develop the intimacy with yourself, sitting there in silence, working on your blind spots and your subconscious patterns, you're giving yourself so much intimacy that you're not even worried of anyone ever abandoning you again. And abandonment is usually our biggest fear, and that is for most of us our biggest driving motivation, fear of abandonment. And a nice guy is terrified of abandonment. A good guy is, I love intimacy. I love people who can meet me on my journey, and I will not compromise my self-discovery for anyone else's story. And I emphasize story. It's one thing to have children. Of course, you have to sacrifice who you are, so much of yourself for your children. That's unconditional love, unconditional giving. But so many people are driven by the story. And so many people, going back to the Hollywood thing, are chasing this happily ever after story. Realizing as a good guy, you're able to say, I don't think you're actually interested in me, Lance. I think you're interested in the role that I may play in your story. And I have no interest in that. And a good guy is able to honor that person who's still chasing a story, saving their time, say, I'm not the person you're looking for. And I wish you well as you continue more.
Wow. Dude, hits home at a level that literally gives me chills with that one. Thank you for that. And, you know, I think that leads nicely into the last topic I want to ask you about a little bit, because I know we have this in common.
I know.
It's so funny, man. I was telling my lady last night, I was like, cause like sometimes you'll be on a podcast and you're like, I'm kind of like struggling to get through this. And, you know, we might end 10 minutes early. And then I was like, I have this feeling with Lance, like, I'm going to have to, like, you know, it's going to be tough to end. There's so much, man. You know, we have so much in common in the fact that we both were professional athletes, you in basketball, me in cycling. You grew up in Mormon fundamentalism. I grew up in Mormonism. Right. And, you know, there's just so much that resonates. And one of the biggest things that I wanted to talk about was this addiction. And you're the first person that I've ever heard call it an addiction. But I spent 2 years with deep, deep work after going through hell myself, trying to figure out what to call it. And it really is the addiction to external validation.
Approval addiction. Absolutely.
Oh my God. And it's something I think that more men don't even realize that they are dealing with. So would you mind talking a little bit more about that? And ultimately, how do you help yourself not get in your own way with that anymore?
First off, understanding whether it's grief or work with addiction is passing clouds. Meaning, some days it's clear blue skies. I got this. Everything's under control. No worries. And some days it's just overcast all damn day long. Like, what the hell is going on? I thought I had already worked through this shit. And then some days it's just intermittent clouds. And just being able to stop and say, all right, there's a cloud. First thing I'm going to do is breathe. Mm. Breathe through it. And that's a crucial step in grieving, learning how to grieve. That there will always be waves of sorrow. There will always be days, even though I've done a lot of work, that I'll look back and I'll miss basketball and there'll be a wave of sorrow that hits me. That what could have been, what might have been. Mm-hmm. Relationship and marriage. We've been split now for 6 years and there still would be passing clouds. And not shaming it and saying, oh, I thought I was healthy, new age era, everything is out of my way and I don't have any more blocks. And with no more blocks, I can manifest wealth and abundance in my life. That's not human. Hmm. And just being able to honor your losses and breathe through them and let them sit with you for a while and say, thank you for how much you've taught me about myself. Because in our greatest losses is our self-discovery. And in that same vein is also the addiction, the approval addiction of validation, external validation, of having someone pat you on the back and say, good job. And an addiction is something that you hate. You hate the fact that you want people to pat you on the back, and you hate that people think they can even judge who you are as a human by some flimsy stat sheet. You hate it so much, and yet you crave it more than anything. Like an alcoholic will tell you, they hate alcohol, and yet they can't stop craving it. Because when you get that pat on the back, as you know, as an athlete, good job. You get that momentary dopamine release that is reprieve.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, I'm a good person. I don't have to worry about it anymore if I'm doing a good job. And so each little dopamine release, you just need it more and more and more. And when it's withheld, you get broody, you go into the corner, you stay up all night because you had a bad event or whatever, bad game. You just obsess about all the little things you could have done better. And you just brood and you destroy relationships around you because you can't stop obsessing about it. But then the next night you go and you have a great game and you're on top of the world. Mm. That's addict personality. That's addict behavior.
Yeah.
And yet socially, approval addiction is socially acceptable. Because you're trying to make your mark in the world. You're achieving, you're doing, you're building up your resume. That means you're a successful person. But at the end of the day, calling a spade is an addiction. Because you're driven by the fear of abandonment. That if I don't do this, I don't have the perfect game, I will not be worthy of love. And so learning to... couple things when it comes up to say, shit, it's here today. Okay, I'm not going to judge myself for being insecure right now. But in that insecurity, let's say, okay, humans operate in two modes, fear, usually fear of abandonment, or trust. 90% of the world operates in fear. Trust is saying, I am just a guest here on this planet for this blink in time. For this little wrinkle in time, I am just a guest. And so, as any good guest would do, I am here, I am in the sacred space. And so, I am not in charge. All I can do is show up the best I can and be of service, be useful, realizing it's not about me. There are three levels of consciousness: individual, tribal, and greater whole. Most people vacillate between the individual, the myopic, and the tribal. The tribal is so addicting because you see people around you confirming your same viewpoint of the world, and you're validated, and you get that little kick of comfort and satisfaction saying, oh, I'm a good person. My narratives and views tell me I'm good. I don't have to have any more growth. I don't have to expand beyond my comfort zone. I can just stay here in my little bubble and feel good and safe because the rest of the world is scary. Greater whole is saying, all right, it's not about me. The greater whole consciousness that even human beings aren't the center of the world. Not only am I not the center of this world, not only is my tribe and culture and family not the center of this world, that we humans are not the center of the universe. And so when you're able to step into that greater whole perspective and realize just how insignificant you are, you then understand just how significant you are to helping expand the global consciousness into evolving beyond childish things. Sounds oxymoronic, but I know you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so with that, when you're able to, whenever I start getting caught in that approval addiction, I say, all right, I have a choice right now. I can be in the individual or the tribal, or I can be brave enough to let me go, let Lance and my stories and my culture and my triggers, I can let that illusion go and understand it's not about me at all. And I surrender all those stories and fears, realizing it doesn't get to be about me. As we move into what's called, people are calling the Aquarian age. And Aquarian energy very much is greater whole consciousness. That is no longer about me. And so that is the skill that I use whenever I start finding myself on a rough day and that addiction for approval is really driving me. I've catch myself, wait, okay, I'm in my addict archetype right now. And we all have an addict archetype, as you heard me say in the book. We all have an addiction to something.
Yeah.
So my addict archetype or my child archetype is driving the wheel right now. Time to tell them, thank you for helping me see where I'm still being unconscious. And now it's time for me to actually be a self-actualized adult and bring a different, more empowered archetype, whether it's the lover or the teacher or the visionary or the philosopher or the athlete or the writer or the poet. I mean, the musician, the artist. We can go through all the archetypes that we have. And what one are we going to bring forth? In trust, asking, how can I best help the universe come through me? It's not for me. It's not about me. It's through me. And so when I move into that level, that greatly dissipates the pressure of the approval addiction.
I love that. And I think just allowing yourself to have that grace in that moment to recognize it is something that's not very common, because we start to self-sabotage and shame ourselves when we're in that moment. So I think that's very, very awesome. Which leads to one of the practices that you talk about in the book, which I had never tried. And we were driving back from the Yosemite area, and I was listening to you, and you went into the heart tapping.
Heart tapping.
Was so powerful. And I think that's something that everybody listening could do immediately, just to get out of the head, back into the heart, and empower themselves. So could we actually do this live? Would you mind just guiding us for 5 minutes through the heart tapping?
What it is so the listeners understand who aren't watching the Zoom video, it's just an open palm. Well, I learned to do this before my games. I would lay on my back, and I would just repeat something like, say, rebound and run, keeping it simple. not in my head, analyzing stats. I got to get my 18 and 12 tonight. It was just rebound and run, which allowed the sensation of my heart being hit to get me in my body, not in my head. The great athletes, when they're in the zone, they're not in their head. And you know this, that you have transcended linear, logical reason, that you're just in what is. You are dancing with what is. You're a dancer at that point. And that's because you are listening to your body and your body is tapped in and you are just flowing with it. And so the heart drumming, yeah, what an easy one that I do every morning when I wake up is just what you're going to do is do a 10 count of an inhale, 10 count hold, and then a 10 count exhale.
Okay.
And let's just go ahead and do 3 rounds of that, man.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Exhale. Inhale. Exhale. Inhale. I mean, I almost always get emotional every time I do that, just because when you're done, it's just everything's quiet, your brain is shut off, and everything seems manageable. Mm. You just allow all these chess pieces that's been stressing you out all day, you know, to say, okay, I see the timing of that. I will get to that when I can, when it's needed. It just puts allow things to be in perspective, but that's what the athlete does when they're in the zone. That we're able to see all these chess pieces around us. And you trust that they will move and you will respond, not react. You will respond accordingly. And nothing will be beyond manageable. So the heart drumming just helps my body get into the zone, tapping into the energetic grid or the frequency of energy that is all around us all the time. And it's a skill that's served me well through lots of crazy stuff, man. And I wish I could say I went to India and I was in Nepal with a Buddhist monk for 2 years learning this, but it was just me one day in a corner of a basketball arena during the pregame announcements when the music is just so loud that even though I don't have my hearing aids in, it's funny, my hearing aids not being in, when I take them out, there's like extra sensitive, like the eardrum is. And so the arena noise is just crazy. So I just learned in those early years, go get in the corner, lay down and be that weird guy laying in a corner, just drumming my chest. Yeah. But that's what allowed me to be just a consistent basketball player for 10 years. playing on every continent around the world for 10 years, except for Antarctica. Little things like that, that would help me center and ground and just get out of my own way and get in the game.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I find so beautiful about that exercise is, and I never realized this until a couple of years ago when I started waking up, was that we spend most of our time and energy trying to get out of our body.
Yes. Isn't that crazy? You know?
And isn't it isn't until we can start to get back into our body, stop running from everything that's happening in here, that, you know, the breakthrough, the inner peace, all that starts to really come. So I really appreciated that exercise, man. I think that's going to be something that I do as a daily practice as well.
But isn't that profound, you to say that we spend so much of our energy to get out of our bodies because we were never given the space, permission, and tools to even be comfortable in our own bodies and recognize and articulate and work with these emotions and feelings that are coming up that are not scary things, really. They're resources. Your body giving you these signals is a resource. That our body is arguably our greatest resource. And yet we spend so much of our lives trying to get away from it.
Yeah.
And you just hit it right on the head there.
Yeah. And it's everywhere, you know, and it's like people think, well, I don't have any major addictions, or I'm not like really running from my pain. And yeah. And sometimes maybe they're right. It's not such a dramatic external thing that they're seeking. It might not be alcohol. It might not be cannabis. It might not be drugs, whatever it is, but it might be they can't stop scrolling through social media.
They can't stop drama,
Netflix. Gossip. You know, like, it's everybody has something, some form of distraction. And so finding those ways to get back into our body is so key, man. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
What are you currently working on for this coming year? And I wanted to ask you, what are you most excited about right now in your life?
What am I most excited about in my life? Great question. I am a driven person. I always like to be moving. And I was close to locking down a hot springs in Montana where I could have a lot more of my own retreats and not always organizing with other property owners that are just charging way too much.
Yeah.
And I nearly had it locked down and ready to go, but then COVID hit.
Mm-hmm.
And that threw everything through a loop, and you know, banks aren't lending to anyone right now. And so that was something I was most excited about, but having to, again, have the humility to adapt and drink my own medicine, so to speak, it was, I can throw a fit and be angry. This isn't to say that I suppress my emotion. I allow myself to be angry and pissed.
Yeah.
Get it out.
Yeah.
Say, okay, you got it out. Now the game's still going.
Yeah.
Let's get back in the game. And so that's something that I have allowed to be on the back burner and allowing and trusting if the universe wants me to do it that way, where it's not about me. I am not the healer. I am simply a bridge to bring people to sacred spaces like that, where Mother Earth, that's how she breathes through hot springs, helps people have their own mirror where they can do their own healing. That is how I would very much like to serve and help. But if universe, if creation, I call it universe creation, because creation implies that we are within it and of it at all times.
Of that.
And not separate from it, like you were taught as a Mormon kid. God's far away. We got to get back to God.
Yeah.
But creation allows me to be a teammate. That we are flowing together, learning together simultaneously. And however, if creation would like me to be of service in another way, okay, I trust that. My story may not like it,
yeah,
but I trust it. And so right now, a lot of it, Brock, is what I'm excited about is this week, I can honestly tell you, last 2 weeks were pretty rough for me because it just was. It was kind of one of those weeks saying, you know what, I'm trying not to feel sorry for myself, but I do feel discouraged because everything seems so chaotic right now. I don't even know how I can even help or be of service. Mm-hmm. But this week has been a lot of moving back into trust and having the humility to get out of my own way. And so I'm pretty simple right now with what I'm excited about, which is just being able to just get back to game face mode and being able to say, okay, I worked through that. I had some stories. I had some self-doubt there for a minute, but that's me. Me being in self-doubt is not living in trust that this universe, this creation is far more intelligent than I could ever be. In my limited human brain, I can't even comprehend what's going on. And all I can do is just get out of my own way and be ready to show up when my number is called, coach. Always ready to get in the game and play. So I'm just grateful right now to just having moved out of a funk and allowing myself space and permission, as all of us do, that you have to give yourself space and permission to let those funks come. And you can't sugarcoat it with toxic positivity all the time.
Yeah.
You have to allow yourself to be human and allow yourself to feel these range of emotions. Because when you allow yourself to feel the range of emotions, your capacity for compassion only grows. Your compassion to meet people where they're at only expands. Mm-hmm. And that is you becoming more cerebral and therefore more useful, as I have said.
It's beautiful, man. Well said. It's well said. And I appreciate that acknowledgement too of like, hey man, I have been in a funk. And I think everybody listening has to resonate with that in some capacity, you know, after the year we had last year and just being like, you know, you see these guys like Tony Robbins, Mr. Positive, but like, mark my words, you know, when his event in San Jose with a full stadium full of people can't move forward, like, he's going to take a moment and be pissed off and be like, okay, shit, now what? All right, we're doing it through streaming, you know? Yeah. It's like everyone's had to adapt. And I love that you just, you know, recognize that, like, hey, it's okay to feel the frustration and everything we're feeling and not sugarcoat it. And now what? So congratulations on getting the game face back, man.
Game face back on, ready to play, ready to be subbed back in when my number is called. And trusting the coach that, all right, he understands my value and he'll utilize my value when the time is right.
I love it, man. I love it. So for everybody listening or watching, what is the best way to get in touch with you and connect?
So Lance Allred 41. 41 is my jersey number. Social media, Lance Allred 41, Twitter, Instagram's there. Or the website Lansard 41. And I appreciate anytime people reach out, but anytime people share the message of the book for people that we love that are going through hard times right now. And it's easier for us to say, oh, I voted for Biden. I'm happy. We won. Eat it, Trumpers. But that's not gonna bring them along with us.
Yeah.
Instead, you could say, you know, I understand you're scared. You wanted the old way. That's not how it plays anymore. And here's a book that might be timely for you. Yeah. And so trusting that the book, even though it came out right when COVID hit and the speaking tour got wiped out, I could say, well, this sucks. Or I could say, well, my book energetically is right on time.
Yeah.
Maybe not commercially right on time, but the book is the antithesis of the old system of commercialism anyway.
Yeah.
And so trusting that it's right on time and the right people who are ready to hear it, it will find its way to them. So I appreciate anyone helping with that. Not from a metric standpoint, but from a human connection level. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, man, thank you for writing it. Thank you for putting the time into it. It really is. It's a message that is so timely. I don't know. It's like sometimes you just read a book and you're just like, you're nodding your head to everything that is being said because it hits. And that's how it was for me. So I can only imagine that it is for, you know, thousands of other people, because with everything happening in the world, it's so easy for people to numb and, you know, to look externally and try to not feel the pain. And you give some really amazing practices and perspectives on how to just bring it all in here, bring it back into the heart, and then everything's going to be okay. So thank you so much, man.
And thank you for recognizing the work, and thank you for the work that you have put in intuitively, altruistically, desperately at times, that allowed you to be at a point where you could even hear those words and recognize those words and meet those words at the level that you're at. And so I have to honor you at the same time.
Thank you, brother. Yeah. Well, I'll have everything in the show notes where people can find you and say hello and link to the book. And again, man, just an honor, and thank you for your time. And thank you everyone for listening. And we will see you all on the next episode. Peace and blessings. I did. I got so much value out of that. And, you know, it was funny because, like, I feel like I didn't get that many questions on in this episode, but Lance was like just answering all my questions as he was talking. So I just let him talk, man. And I hope that you guys got as much as I did out of that. I think one of my favorite parts in that conversation was the discussion, nice guys versus good guys. That, like, really, really resonated with me. And I hope that other men out there, that really resonated with them as well. So I'd love to hear from you guys. What was your biggest takeaway from the episode? Thank you so much for listening. Make sure you subscribe so you get the updates on our weekly release. And without further ado, I will wish you guys an amazing day. We'll see you on the next episode. Peace.